bitte.
Hello and welcome to the second edition of David Bowie Album to Album. And for this edition, I'm going to be talking about Heroes, the album recorded in Berlin. And I'm going to be talking about Heroes with Charlotte Hatherley, the guitarist, formerly of Ash, and now a much, well, as they say, highly sought after session musician and composer. And Charlotte is a huge Bowie fan and an authoritative source of information when it comes to guitar trickery, which of course is central to the 1977 album Heroes. Heroes is also one of my favourite albums. In fact, it probably, if I had to say which album was my favourite, I would probably say Heroes, just because, I don't know, it's an album that's really meant a lot to me over the years, just because it's a pure cinematic experience for me. I built up such a vivid, romantic, ideal world through this album. So much so that when I first encountered it and really fell in love with it, I really wanted to go and see Berlin. For my, the city of Isherwood, the Bowie, of Weimar decadence, and you know, all the typical cliches, all those things. But Bowie's Heroes somehow articulated that for me. Today I live in Berlin, and a large part of that is due to Heroes, I think. I'm actually standing right outside the studio where Heroes was recorded, just by Potsdamer Platz, as you heard just now on the train. I am aware this is probably a little bit sad, but I wanted you to have the full immersive experience, and seeing as I'm quite close by, and it's easier for me to get here than, say, the Cherokee Studios in Los Angeles, or the Lookout Studios in New York, or the other places where David laid down tracks. The street I'm walking down at the moment was pretty much a no man's land back then. It was desolate, it was scary as hell. I mean, you know, you wouldn't want to be caught out there late at night. But this is where they came. I think that feeling definitely permeated the album. There was this sense of underlying dread and of desperation. Living in West Berlin at the time, living in East Berlin at the time, having this great big wall patrolled by soldiers and guns and spotlights everywhere was really, from the people I've spoken to who lived through it here, a terrifying and psychologically distressing experience, as you can imagine. Anyway, so all this fed into Heroes, and of course the title track was a song which, to me and to many German friends I've spoken to here, really reflects this sense of sort of desperate, doomed romanticism. I mean, it's a song that the studio becomes an integral part of in its dimensions, its huge ceiling, the fact that Visconti might Bowie up in such a way that he would have to shriek dementedly to activate microphones. The album was recorded fairly quickly, as you'll hear in our conversation, yet they brought so much innovation and excitement to this album. So much was thrown in here, so much energy and feeling. It's black, it's icy, there's intimations of dread. You imagine the late night dive bars, the punks, the anarchists, the whole movement in Kreuzberg especially, which was very strong at the time, of resistance, political engagement, nihilism. I mean, punk was swirling around at this time, and in a way, as that famous tagline put it, there's old wave, there's new wave, and there's Bowie, which was the record label's way of promoting the album, which is actually very true. This album stands out on its own as a work of art in itself, articulating that feeling of Berlin in the 1970s, revealing Bowie's inner demons and dreads as they continue to plague and torment him, even though he'd left Los Angeles. It's a document of a time and a man now gone forever. So here we are. This is me and Charlotte Hatherley talking about Heroes. I hope you enjoy. When I approached people to be on this podcast, a lot of people were humming and hawing and hesitating and suggesting one album that meant a lot to them and then writing back.
iPhone.
Was that you?
I think so.
I think your iPhone's just done something to that speaker.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but it's good to know it's there. So that's okay. That's fine. It might order us a pizza or something otherwise, but be careful what you say. So a lot of people were hesitating and, you know, changing their minds. But what I liked about your response is that you came back straight away and said, heroes.
Yes.
So why? Why have you chosen heroes to talk about?
Well, I kind of got into Bowie when I was 13, 14. I'm 38. So I think at that time, he was coming out with... It was Black Tie, White Noise was coming out at about that time. And I was sort of working my way through. I'm not sure if I really knew like the correct order of the records or if I was just judging it by...
I don't know. I'm sort of throwing it out.
Echoes.
Yeah, let's just keep that going.
Yeah. So I think with Heroes, I'd gone through Low, which was obviously the bleaker of the Berlin trilogy. And Heroes was the next in line. And I think... It just appealed to me at that moment in time. I think I was playing guitar and I was starting to think about, like I was just joining a band when I was 15, and it's a rock record essentially.
Yeah.
In like this crazy bleak, environment. So it has the side two and the instrumentals and like the more experimental stuff, but the side A just blew my mind. And I think primarily Robert Fripp, his guitar is like, was such a massive influence on me. And that record was just endlessly played.
I think one of the most amazing things about this album is that great story about Fripp being called up in New York and Brian Eno literally saying, hey, let me pass the phone over to David. And David saying, hey, we want you to come and put some guitar on. And Fripp had sort of semi-retired at that point, but he was like, okay. And he flew, now tell me if I get this wrong, he flew into Berlin, where they were recording, obviously, and without hearing anything in advance, just basically soloed over a couple of tracks, I think maybe Beauty and the Beast.
Heroes. Heroes and Blackout. He was just first takes.
Right.
And I think that was generally the way that they worked from what I've read. Eno was all about the oblique strategies and it was all chants and they didn't want anything to be rehearsed or too thought about. And you can really hear that in the recording. It's completely overblown and chaotic.
Kind of like almost like a wall of sound, but a really dark wall of sound.
Really massive wall of sound. And it's such a unique sounding record. I mean, it has a similar sonic... sounds to Low, which is all the Visconti treatments, but I think so Robert Fripp being involved in Heroes just completely gave it this unique flavour. And his guitar is, I mean, it's quite embedded in the mix, but if you really listen to it, like especially in Blackout, his guitar is just insane. It's just constant as well. It's constant noodling. But there's nothing about it that seems too clever.
Right.
And I think that is because they are first takes and he's just very spontaneously responding to what he's hearing. So you get this incredibly exciting sound, and I think that was the method that they employed for all the takes. So a lot of his vocal takes were first takes.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like they must have been so excited to work that way.
As a guitarist, what could you maybe break down a little bit of what Fripp was doing? How was he getting those sounds? I mean, I know Eno and Visconti had all their sort of boxes of tricks, and we'll come onto that later. But what was Fripp doing? How did he get that really mental, like you mentioned in Blackout, that really sort of screechy, skronky guitar effect?
Yeah, it's a very tubey, heavily distorted. he's got supreme control of the feedback and distortion, and he's probably got lots of his pedals and effects going on, and his Frippertronics, which are probably not so much in effect here.
What are Frippertronics?
It's his special like harmonic sort of invention.
Right.
And he I mean, he was very about this prog rock guitarist, but at the same time, like, quite dirty and filthy. So King Crimson, who I love as well, are sort of in that prog family, but they're not. I mean, it's actually later King Crimson did become incredibly clever, math rocky, but I think at this point he's just making noise. And it kind of reminds me a little bit when I, because I really love Tin Machine as well. Reeves Cabrel is very similar. So he
definitely, yeah,
seen him play live. The way that he uses that feedback and distortion and the whammy bar on his guitar.
It's very controlled, isn't it? I mean, with Reeves Cabrel, he really is on top of that. It's this very organized chaos.
Yeah.
That goes
but it's also very, with Fripp, it's really melodic. And he's using all these Phrygian scales and all these, like, guitar scales where it's never atonal. It always sounds sort of exotic and beautiful and melodic. And the other record that I really love is Scary Monsters, and I think Fripp's guitar in Scary Monsters is, like, a more adult version of Heroes. It's a bit more prepared and thought out.
It doesn't guitar. Maybe have that same kind of spontaneity or that immediacy that Heroes does.
Yeah, his guitar in Scary Monsters is astonishing. But I think it's a similar thing with Fashion, was that he was thrown in and it was like one or two takes. And
right. So that's how they deal with Fripp, isn't it? It's just like, right, we can't have him around for any longer than necessary. So he's obviously that really kind of screechy, hysterical guitar solo in Fashion, that was Fripp.
Yeah.
Right.
It's Fripp, and they cut it up, so he would do like a couple of takes, which, and I think this is how he worked, Bowie worked in general with a backing band, is that he would have the band rehearse and arrange an idea or a demo, and then they'd record it, and then he'd come into the studio with Eno and Tony Visconti, and then arrange or cut it all up.
Right, right.
So nothing was above being messed about with.
Everything was open, basically. So
everything was open.
Yeah. He would come in. I read somewhere that the music itself, I mean, the backing tracks were done in an astonishingly short amount of time.
Mm.
We were talking a few days almost. It was like bam, bam, bam. They rattle through them. And let's just for a second. I don't know what is the problem with. is she complaining about something?
Oh, she loves it.
She loves it. She's chipping in, I think. Yeah. So I'm like, no. That was Dennis Davis on drums. But I wanted to talk a bit about the band, and this is, I think, is a good moment. So we have the amazing drummer Dennis Davis, who sadly died, I think, not so long ago.
2016.
Yeah, yeah. He died the same year as Bowie. Yeah. But I think, I mean, did he play on Young Americans?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think Young Americans, Station, Low. But really, if you hear him on this album, he's just going absolutely batshit crazy. I mean, what is it? Is it Blackout?
Yeah, the fills in Blackout.
Right, that's it.
Yeah.
And I read somewhere that he'd actually set his kit up on a riser. So he was about 5 foot up. And I think the bass player was saying it was crazy because I was standing right by the bass drum. And it was like being punched repeatedly in the head. But on that track, Blackout, they record like that. And he was, you hear him, and he's steering the band.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah.
Those astonishing fills.
Yeah, I mean, he is amazing. And he was brought in for the Young Americans record. And it's like the elements of the Young Americans sound that I can hear in Heroes, especially in...
really?
Yeah, in the final track, Secret Life of Arabia.
Really?
You can hear it in, because that's a lot of Carlos Alomar.
Yeah, yeah.
That's probably most of his influence is on that track, which is sort of stuck at the very end of the record after all the...
It's a bit weird, isn't it, where it comes, because you sort of...
Yeah.
It really kind of jars quite a bit.
Yeah.
And a bit, this very kind of fractured funk disco feel.
After this sort of nice pastoral environmental stuff. I kind of think that's, a lot of people don't really like that song that much, but I just love that song. The groove is amazing. Mm. I think that's what Carlos Animal brought this funk and... very clean melodic guitar, and then Fripp would come in and just be like the Jackson Pollock and just splatter this guitar noise everywhere. But Alomar was a lot more sort of precise in his playing.
That's true. I mean, thinking about that track, you really can hear those two very distinct guitar players. I mean, Alamar is doing those lovely arabesque sort of swirly bits, you know, very clean and bright.
Yeah.
And then Fripp is doing the far more crunchy, dirty thing. And there's a direct tension going on between these two elements there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Alamar is like much more of a studio guy. So Fripp, they'd fly Fripp in and then he'd do his thing and go away. Whereas I think, get the impression, Carlos Alamar was a lot more of a sort of a really important member of any studio environment that he was in. And also with the Heroes thing, I think because they'd already done Low, and Low was sort of like an experiment, and I don't think Carlos Alomar, I mean, he's been quite public saying that he was quite reactive against the Brian Eno's tactics.
Really?
Because he was like a trained guitarist.
Right, and, right.
Brian Eno was coming in pointing a stick at chords, and I think he was a little bit affronted by it.
Right.
And was like, what the fuck is this?
Well, I mean, you could get two sort of more disparate backgrounds. I mean, this egghead from the home counties who'd been to art school and was very conceptual and come up through Roxy and then Ambient. And then this, where was Alamar from? Was he from Brooklyn?
Yeah, like New York.
Right, proper straight up New York guy.
Yeah.
And very different backgrounds, united by Bowie.
Mm.
And I think that also, I read something about that for Lodger as well, because Lodger really was taking this randomness to extremes.
Yeah.
I think on, is it on Boys Keep Swinging or something, where they all play, they all swap instruments.
Swap instruments,
and it has that deliberately really ramshackle kind of feel. But I imagine, as you say, Alamar must have been really,
He was,
not sure about the ball guy.
Yeah, totally. And he said that he was a bit, Bowie and Eno had this very sort of European intellectualism that he just wasn't on board with. He couldn't relate to it. So I think he found Low difficult. So by the time they got to Heroes, Low had, I mean, it was the same year, which always blows my mind. It was only a few months later that they did this, but Low was a success and it got good reviews. And I think going into the studio for Heroes, there was a much more excited, positive energy, and Bowie was a lot healthier and a lot happier. And you can kind of hear that in the music. And then by the time they get to Lodger, it's almost like it was still good stuff in Lodger, but it wasn't quite, the magic wasn't quite there. So I feel like Heroes is sort of, this is the sweet spot in the middle where they just seem like they were having fun. And you can hear that inside A, it's just, those songs are just ridiculous.
That's a good point. The people refer to Low, Hero and Lodger as the Berlin Trilogy. And it's fairly well known that Heroes was the only album that was recorded in Berlin.
Yeah.
But the point you made is absolutely true. Low was a very psychically difficult album. He'd just come, I think he was in the midst of moving from LA, where he was really in a bad state, you know, like with drugs and marriage breaking down and, you know, all sorts of issues, management problems, everything. And that's reflected in the music. And it must have been an absolute shock for his record label to be given this album, which was just half of like almost desultory short electronic sketches and all delivered in that sort of rather shrugging kind of alienated way. But Heroes definitely has got something to it. There's like a real revitalized energy. And I think a large part of that is Berlin. If you read interviews about him at the time and read what he's said since about Berlin, it was an incredibly rejuvenating experience being in the city, you know, being more or less anonymous.
Yeah.
Soaking up that wonderful, mythical Berlin mystique. And, of course, the studio they recorded in, Hansa Studios, I mean, this building itself, I mean, I was there for the Black Star launch.
Right.
Where they actually had a record party the day that it was launched. And I remember being in the main Meisterhall, and you just look around and you think, whoa, this is the place where there's this great story about for Heroes, and we'll come back to this in a bit, but Visconti set up three mics.
Yeah.
So one right in front of him, very heavily compressed, and then another one next to him, and then his voice would actually trigger a gate, which would then. So that's why you have that incredible histrionic thing. But to be in this studio, it used to be a Nazi banqueting hall.
Yeah, that's right.
In the 1920s, the Expressionists would do exhibitions there of painting and stuff. Mm. It all seeps into this record.
Yes. I mean, hearing about that makes me so nostalgic for those days where you would go to a music studio and, I mean, it's such a collaborative record. I mean, he was the greatest collaborative musician. And you would just get the best of the best, put them in a room, and it just seemed like that was like a magic formula. Whatever happened between those guys, the band and Eno and Visconti, was just a truly magical thing. And I think it was really amazing. Recording studios can just...
They can just definitely have an atmosphere.
And, like, and you can see how he would totally be into that, because he's quite obsessive about his religion and rituals. And I think he probably had quite a fascination with the Nazi party, and just to be there at that time in such a place that was used for these like Nazi big grand bombs. And I think Visconti was saying they were using microphones that they'd get out of boxes and there'd be swastikas on.
Really?
And you can just imagine him being just so sort of swept up in that it quite like post-war gloom, and the fact that there was still like terrible stuff going on every day. It was a dangerous place.
It was a very dangerous place. They were right on the border of the wall, and they were just by Potts and Platts. And if you see around that area of pictures at the time, it literally just was a wasteland. And very famously, from the studio control room, which is now a cafe, you can see down where the wall was, and that whole story about him seeing the couple by the wall, which then apparently was Tony Visconti and one of the backing singers, Antonia Maas. But then, interestingly, Antonia Maas has since denied that and said that it wasn't them at all, because her affair with Visconti only began after the recording.
That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, have you played in any sort of iconic studios? Have you been into a studio and been kind of overawed with the history and the moment of it?
I've been in lots of recording studios, but nothing that has made me feel that way. No, I did a lot of couple of records with Ash in Rockfield Studios, which is quite famous. But no, I mean, I don't really. I wouldn't romanticize it in that way, unless it was David Bowie.
I don't think Bowie ever used Rockfield.
No, I don't think so. In America, in the studio that Nirvana used, and but I don't know if I sort of. I never got a sort of spooky association with anything like that.
So we're kind of coming back to the studio, and the studio itself was another component of the recording, basically. It was a big part of it. What do you think about the team then? So Visconti, long-term collaborator and sort of interpreter.
Yeah.
Eno had been along for the ride with Lowe and was very much in evidence here. And that was like the main core. I mean, how do you see these guys working together? What's your take on their dynamic?
Well, they seem like, there is a core team. Tony Visconti, Brian Eno, David Bowie. And I kind of think, like, Brian Eno was, like, his Zen master. He would just... He was sort of the brains behind it all, and probably was such a massive influence on David Bowie. And I know there's, like... I know Adam Buxton's done that. Very funny
fantastic
animation about Tony Visconti not
getting... Tony Visconti, I'm co-producing this album. That's right, I can press that button because I'm co-producer.
Exactly.
Do you know that someone played that to Visconti, and in some documentary they played it to him, and he's like, it's not funny.
Really?
I actually did a lot more. No, I listened to... Actually, it was on Buxton's podcast. He interviewed Eno.
And he said,
what did... You know, have you ever heard that thing? Yeah. And Brian was like, oh, yes, we have heard it. And I think it's rather unfair on Paul Tony. I mean, we could tell he was really laughing.
Oh, he seems like such a nice guy, Tony Visconti. I kind of... It seems as though, like, from what you read, that they were having fun. Mm. And, like, you know, he wasn't mythologized these records. And... imagine it to be like this. Well, imagine Lowe to be like quite a dark, intense period. But from what he's talked about and Eno's talked about, they just had a great time and like really enjoyed it, especially like the dark second sides. It's like they had the greatest fun doing that. So it just seems like they had like a sort of amazing relationship, and that Brian Eno had just become at that period like his most trusted collaborative musician. And then they have the band who, you know, it's a difficult thing with Bowie to figure out, like, the in the studio, like, where the magic begins, because it seems like it's such a sort of separated experience. Like, the band always seem to be, like, quite separate. So they'll get Fripp in to do guitar stuff, but then he'll go away and they'll cut it up.
Mm.
But it seems like he'll cut it up with Eno and Visconti. So they seem like they're the core nucleus of the decisions
being
made. And it's also, like, such a spontaneous way of working. Like, I don't think I've ever been in a studio where, you know, you would do a vocal tape without any lyrics being written. Mm. I mean, that's just crazy.
But this was the Iggy Pop thing, and that's another big part of this, is Iggy Pop's sort of constant manic presence just on the sidelines here.
Because between Low and Heroes, he'd gone on tour with Iggy Pop, and he produced The Idiot, and then also in that same period of the Lou Reed record as well. So it's just, like, such a crazy time.
Did he work on Lou Reed record around then?
Yeah, in that same sort of Berlin era.
All right, which one was that?
The Satellite Love record.
Oh, that was Transformer.
Transformer.
Yeah.
He produced that as well.
But that was a little bit earlier. That was, I think, 71, 72? Walk on the Wild Side.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Now I'm being the pedant. Actually, I think you'll find. I think you'll find that was 1972, Miss Heatherly.
Fuck.
Fucking hell.
The 70s. From 71 to 70, that's right, 77. And because this is his 12th record.
Yeah.
The Heroes.
And he was only 30.
Fucking mental.
30.
He just turned 30, yeah.
Isn't it sickening?
So, yeah, it's a crazy thing. But, you know, I have to think about who's... talking of, like, Eno, Visconti and Bowie, like, who's calling the shots, you know? Is it an equal thing? Is Eno the one making more of the sort of maverick intellectual decisions, or is it a sort of totally equal...
I think my take on it has always been that Bowie would defer to Eno a bit, because Brian, I mean, in their, you know, both of them have given accounts of the sessions, and I do think that maybe if it came down to it, if Eno would have the casting vote, basically. That's just my impression of things I've read and all that.
Yeah.
You know, obviously all the Pete and Dud imitations as well.
Yeah.
But I think Bowie was very consciously collaborating with all these people to varying extents. So of course Visconti has his role, which is crucial. But Eno was there for that period, and he wanted to sort of get everything he could out of Eno and utilise him. Because I think also that around this time, Low Heroes, he'd really changed the way he was writing songs. Like, if you look at the structure of songs, and you look at the lyrics, and the way that he's coming up with the lyrics and the flow and the chords and everything, it all seems to change around Station Low. So this is kind of like a new way of songwriting.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And a large part of that is informed by sort of, like, you know, chance happenings. I mean, obviously that was a theme before, but Oblique Strategies, I think, really did shape, especially side two, the instrumentals.
Yeah, and I Ching was a massive influence for Brian Eno. Yeah, everything to do with chance and just deconstructing, like, the way the arrangements are. So I think Eno was talking about Breaking Glass and Low. That was just something they thought they would return to and arrange it properly. And Eno was like, no, just leave it like that. And
really? They thought that was like a sketch almost?
Yeah. They'd go back and arrange it properly.
Right.
And Eno was like, oh, no, it's just leave it like it is. It's meant to be. And you kind of, you can imagine Bowie being like, oh, wow.
You can't do that. Yeah.
and now it seems like, yeah, sure, you know, anything, you can do anything now.
Yeah.
But I think at that time, it was probably a completely new way of him working. And then by the time he gets back round to doing like proper demos before going to studio, which he did for Scary Monsters, I mean, that record, you know, Ashes to Ashes, the way that sounds compared to any of the tracks on Heroes is completely worlds apart. It sounds like a really polished, produced thing. Whereas Heroes, the production... aesthetic and effects are really revolutionary and amazing. I think Tony Visconti changed the way people heard drums being recorded, and he uses the Eventide and affects the vocals. And
the Eventide is a sequencer, processor?
It's like it's an effects unit.
Right.
So you can put, I think you weren't supposed to put drums through it, but he did.
Yeah.
And he loved what he could get out of it, and then you put vocals through it. And at the same time as this, they're playing around with synthesizers in a way that they'd never done. So you get like all these like really new and interesting sounds, but I don't know if it's like production wise. I mean, it's crazy. It's a really quite a cluttered, overwhelming sound. And then you contrast that with Scary Monsters, which is very clean and sounds expensive. Heroes is really dirty.
Yeah.
Low is quite dirty as well. Lodge is quite different. It's got a very different colour to it. But those two records especially have this sort of real gnarliness to it that really appealed to me at the time.
I don't know if you've seen that YouTube clip of Visconti explaining how he put together Heroes. It's from a documentary somewhere. And it's about 20-25 minutes, and it's absolutely fantastic because he actually takes you through the whole multi-track recording.
Right, yes.
Starting off with, I think, maybe Alomar just doing like a basic, you know, rhythm guitar piece, and then building up. And there are some really strange things going on there. I mean, for example, there's a very kind of metallic ringing, which I always thought was a tambourine. Apparently there's an ashtray in the studio, which then Bowie just started hitting. So you can hear it now, and there's obviously a ton of echo on it. But what really got me about that was when you add these layers and more layers and more layers, it almost builds up into, like we said earlier, like a sort of Phil Spector kind of thing. But the intensity is so calibrated, it just has this huge surging effect. We mentioned earlier the microphones. So you had three microphones set up in the studio. The louder Bowie shrieked, the more microphones would trigger. And, of course, then the final microphone would capture all the reverberations around this giant hall.
Yeah.
But what that meant was that Bowie hit a point around, I think, halfway through, where he really starts screaming. But then he has to maintain that intensity.
Mm-mm-mm.
Otherwise the mic will shut down, and then you'll get this really noticeable drop-off in the intensity. Oh. So that's why he almost sounds like he's going crazy in this song, you know, and he's really shrieking. And I don't think maybe you think differently, but I can't think of another single vocal performance, in his career that matches that, just for intensity. Heroes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hysterical. A lot of the vocals on the record are very hysterical. Yeah. Like, even from the very first track, Beauty and the Beast, the vocals are crazy. And
what's going on with that? It's got this
heavily affected, which is the Eventide.
Right, oh, that's the Eventide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's just running it through everything. And it's very... Compared to Low, where the vocals are really depressed, blank, and quite cold.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, everything on this record is just...
It's just amped up to 11, isn't it? It's
very emotional. I think there's a couple of songs... When I was listening to it for the first time, I got like a sense of him being romantic and quite like sexy. I think it's in Blackadder, the Kiss You in the Rain, and then Sons of the Silent Age, the whole Baby, Baby, Baby. It's sexy. There's quite sexy about it, whereas Low is not sexy at all.
Low wasn't sexy, but do you think that sexiness is almost ironic, you know, the inverted commas around the title track? And I've always felt that, I mean, I know that there's a lot of sexy language, but there's, to my ears, there's always been a sort of slight knowing, sort of sneering, like there's this real bitterness about it, which you get in the title track.
Yeah.
Everything from the inverted commas around the title to the sort of like real sucker punches that he just drops into the lyrics every now and again, when you think it's going to go into like a big romantic direction. You know, it's just, he just brings it down with just for one day, or, you know, I can be mean and drink, you know, it's a strange one.
I don't think he was until Absolute Beginners. I mean, that's his, Absolute Beginners for me is like, if I ever get married, that would be my song.
Well, that's an unashamed
That's romantic. An unashamed romantic sort of song, which I feel like he never really gets them until the 80s, until Let's Dance. He never really makes those big declarations of love. And, you're right, it's always a bit tongue-in-cheek, it's a bit, like, self-referential or cinematic, or, you know, taking these sort of very obvious cinematic, overblown themes. But at the same time, he never looks so good. Like, for me, to see him, he looks healthy, he's got, like, a...
Oh, he looks great then.
Doesn't have any great makeup. Hair. Yeah. And he's got, like... I mean, even that classic Top of the Pops Heroes...
Mm.
He looks very sort of dainty and like effeminate, but at the same time, he looks like a boy, like a man for the first time. As I was watching him sort of following through, you know, those records, I mean, Low, he's very sexy and The Man Who Fell to Earth, but he kind of, you know, is very thin and sort of looks quite unwell.
He looks a bit peaky, doesn't he?
Looks a bit peaky.
He needs a good meal, doesn't he? I still would though.
Amazing cheekbones.
He has, but you could hang a coat on them, couldn't you?
You could. Probably in Heroes, he's like Mr. Jeans and leather jacket.
And he's filled out a bit and he looks great.
Just fucking great. So I think that for me, that was these really exciting guitar songs, and I was learning the guitar parts of Joe the Lion, and I could sit down.
Really? You could. You're getting all the Fripp parts and
everything. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I tried to learn the guitar sort of playing lots of Beatles songs, and you were there with your effects playing like...
Yeah. Well, that's the Joe the Lion riff is kind of one of the easier ones.
Which one? So what kind of tuning was that when you were messing around? Is it a really weird tuning, or is it just a
standard? Well, I was just using
right
normal tune. I think all the noodly stuff. I remember trying to play Fashion, but
what, that little intro bit? I mean, that's a great bit of frippery, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's so good. Boom, boom, boom. And like the way he plays off Carlos Alomar, it's just so brilliant. But there's not that many moments on Heroes, but the combination of like dirtiness, sexiness, and the pop of it. I mean, it's all this, the piano parts, it's like boogie woogie pop stuff going on.
On Heroes?
Yeah, totally. You can say God, it's Monday. That bit, and then the Blackout was totally, it's just really groovy stuff.
It's funny that a lot of people have pointed to that line as being a great, I think Eno said it was one of the greatest lines in Bowie's kind, just the way he says, it's Monday.
Yeah, and suddenly the vocals get super close and dry, and there's like a major shift in the way the whole production goes. And just those little elements that just make...
The working title was John the Lennon. John the Lennon went to the bar, a couple of drinks. I mean, it could have been. I mean, like we were saying earlier, he had this real, real fondness for Lennon. But it was, I think, referencing Chris Burden, the performance artist.
Yes.
Who had very famously nailed himself to a car. And Bowie at the time was... Oh, I mean, he always had that fascination with audacity, with people doing really, really extreme out there things and sort of that... And I think he always had this sort of slight voyeuristic thing about it.
Him being in Berlin, going to all these art shows, hanging out with Tangerine Dream, all these like krautrock legends at the time, being in these dark, dingy bars until 5 or 6 in the morning, just watching it all happen and taking it all in, which by all accounts is what he did. What an amazing time. And that, you know, Berlin's obviously completely changed. I can't think of many places that I've been to in the world that would be like that, where you would go and be sort of anonymous for him and be in this place which is just in just such a weird juxtaposition in history. What an amazing thing.
Everything just seems to come together at that time. He was there when the wall was dividing the city. He was in Kreuzberg and Neukölln and Schöneberg, these places just inside the wall.
Yeah.
He was in a very immigrant neighbourhood. I mean, famously, his flat was above a Turkish mechanic or something.
Yeah.
And to go from L.A., and, like, you know, all the schlock and the cocaine and madness of Los Angeles to a shitty little flat in Berlin really had that effect.
Yeah, God, it sounds just amazing. I mean, I've always wanted to do something like that because I've always lived in London. And I always thought, God, I should really, you know, go somewhere and write a record and immerse yourself. But it's just never worked out that way. And I think these days, you know, you record a record in your bedroom. It's like so rare that you would be able to, like, go to a studio like that. It seems like such quite a decadent thing.
I mean, if you could do that, where would you go? I mean, if you could pick any place on earth.
I went to Johannesburg recently, and that's the first place I've ever been where I was genuinely scared. And it was hardcore, but it was beautiful and wonderful. And the music, I played a festival, Afropunk festival, and the young South Africans were just incredible, and they looked amazing, and the fashion was just wild, and it was really exciting. The music that I heard just blew my mind, and it was so alien to me, and I thought, yeah, I could come here. But that's the kind of stuff that I can imagine. You know, Bowie was such an enthusiastic music fan and a collector.
He was a magpie, wasn't he? I mean, he would just pick up a bit of this, a bit of that.
And I think at that time, Kraftwerk were... Like, he was already playing Kraftwerk songs at his live shows before he went on stage. And he was obviously aware of Tangerine Dream and a lot of those more experimental German bands. And you kind of think at a time where you really have to go out and find these bands, and it's local knowledge, not like it is now. Right. So I think there was a story of, like, Brian Eno working with, it might have been Cannes, I might have that wrong, going to Germany and sort of doing some jam sessions with this krautrock band, and then taking these tapes away, and some of those songs becoming tracks from Heroes.
Oh, really?
Like, instrumental tracks. And then years and years later, because wasn't Heroes like the title of a
It was. I think it was Neu had a track called Hero.
Yeah.
Around 75, 76. I think Bowie reached out to, again, I can't remember who it was, but it was someone either in Neu or Cannes, Michael Rauter maybe, and just said, hey, do you want to come and produce my record?
Right, right.
And this guy was like, is sync? Maybe not. No. Because he was, I mean, he had that very kind of puppyish enthusiasm. I really like your music.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to come and produce my next record.
Yeah.
And but so what, Eno was working with them?
Yeah, he went into their farmhouse.
Right.
Farmhouse/studio. It was almost like he was doing field research. It was like a year or two before they even went out there. But in those days, you know, you walk off with a reel of tape, and there was notes on it, and once some of the tracks ended up sort of being, you know, Barcelona versions of that on the record. But it goes to show, like, the kernels of those sort of influences were there.
It's extraordinary, that B-side. So we start, again, like Low, we have mainly instrumentals on the B-side. We start off with V2 Schneider.
Yeah.
We then go into Sense of Doubt, and I think it's Moss Garden.
Yeah.
And just across those four pieces, there's such a huge diversity of ideas and of instrumentation. Mm. And like you said before, the Oblique Strategies played a large part in shaping this. I mean, a lot of it was down to chance. But if we just maybe have a quick look at just some of the more notable aspects. I mean, for me, I think V2 Schneider is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's very Germanic to my ears, obviously, and that's referenced in the title. I think a V2 was a German warplane.
Yeah.
And there's some debate amongst the kind of people that debate these things, if Schneider was a reference to Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk. But a very simple structure. It's got Dennis Davis doing this very military snare fills, and then this sort of weird sax. Now, Bowie was, he got the sax out again on this album. Like, you know, the sax makes an appearance every now and again. And it's kind of, conventionally, his sax is not great.
Yeah.
But I think here it's just fabulous, the way it all coheres into this.
Yes, and he says that he came in on the wrong beat.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Or part of their strategy was like, there are no mistakes, and or pretend your mistake is a hidden intention. So a lot of the instrumentals were born from the oblique strategies, and so they would take two cards and Eno and Bowie, and they wouldn't tell each other what it was, so they both work separately with two different intentions, and then at the end of the day they'd play what they'd both done.
Wow.
And you know, I can imagine most of the time it would just be like this beautiful accident of like some piece of music that you would never have intentionally written, and that's just like a wonderful thing.
I have oblique strategies.
Okay.
Do you want to, shall we play some oblique strategies?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah? Okay, I'm going to fire up oblique strategies, and I'm going to tell you what it says to do. Discipline self-indulgence. Imagine, do you want to be Brian? I'll be Dave.
Discipline self-indulgence.
Discipline self-indulgence.
That's just one.
That's just one. That's discipline. All it says. What would you do with that if you'd been putting down a track and you weren't quite sure what it was going to go?
Discipline. Discipline, you would probably strip back and get rid of stuff.
Okay, so pare it down.
But at the same time, self-indulgence.
You see the inherent tension here.
So maybe the tracks that you are left with, for instance, say you had Bowie doing a ridiculous sax take.
Which there were no shortage of, I imagine.
Then just make whatever you do have ridiculously self-indulgent.
Right, yeah.
But keep it tight. Keep the arrangement tight. I mean, I suppose these two tensions, you can make it work. You can interpret it in any way.
All right, so next one.
Yes.
Your mistake was a hidden intention.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, this is what you were saying.
That's what I say all the time.
All the time. It's my motto. I live by that. Okay. Only a part, not the whole.
Only a part, not the whole.
Is this what you're saying, then, sort of stripping it back again, another way of looking at that?
Well, Eno was always... There was something interesting that he said about Outside. That he said Bowie just wants everything to be loud and big in the mix, and that Eno's all about taking stuff out and creating space, and I can feel that with David Bowie. It's like it's production. Like he loves the drums being massive, and like when those songs are big, they're really fucking big. And Eno's almost like sort of always kicking back against that and trying to sort of keep it in check.
Bowie's always going large.
Yeah.
Huge vision, huge scope.
Yeah.
Eno's like, pull it back down.
Pull it back down. I mean, and it's so great to have a person like that with you in life. I made a note. He said for Moss Garden, they had two different strategies. Bowie had a card saying destroy everything, the mythology of musicians taking drugs. Like, it never got in the way of him doing...
He always said that, didn't he? I mean, especially in Young Americans, Station to Station. It was like full on, you know, snowstorms everywhere. Yeah. But it was just to keep everyone in the studio going around. I think Carlos Alomar had just started working with him then, and he was like, bloody hell. You know, this guy does not stop.
Yeah. And I've just never been able to do that.
He tried. Come on, damn it.
Okay. Talking about Heroes, those lyrics, they don't mean anything.
What do you mean, actually? The title track, Heroes?
On the record.
Yeah.
I mean, Heroes is a pretty straightforward classic.
I don't know. I disagree. I think its genius lies in the fact that it's deceptively straightforward.
Mm.
I think that was underlined by, I think, 2010 when the X Factor try to appropriate it and do it as some sort of like, you know,
yeah,
horrible sing-along version, and you know, everyone was sort of like over-emoting wildly and stuff. But when you break it down, I mean, let's look at this song. When you break it down, it is very abstract initially. I could be king, you could be a queen, and nothing. It's like a couple, you know, a man and a woman realizing they're in a very strange place, but also romanticizing. But like we said earlier, the romanticism is tempered by something, by cynicism or by a darkness. And then right at the end, you get like a very firm sense of place, standing by the wall, guards shooting over our heads. And then it becomes like this real story. But yeah, that song's always really beguiled me, because he always, just when you think it's going to be a romantic song or a admission of love, something, it all shifts.
But I just think, if you think about the way the lyrics are written, I mean, they're fairly spontaneous. Mm. And I don't think you can assign too much to that. I just don't. It's open to interpretation, and you can make it into this, make it as profound as you want, or you can take it as a throwaway thing. I think it's the way that he sings it becomes really impassioned, and suddenly it's very emotive. I think those. His lyrics are always, they never really go that deep.
But that in itself is interesting, when you have such, and on this album we were saying that there was an unprecedented level of just sheer passion and energy in a certain way, like this, like this kind of screaming and the distortion and everything. And yet you feel that the lyrics themselves aren't quite...
Yeah, because with the lyrics, was there like a stream of consciousness? And what is a stream of consciousness? Just passing thoughts and passing feelings. There's nothing... They're clouds floating by. I don't think you could hang too much. I don't think he was hanging too much.
Right.
They were just coming out. And that's... kind of ties in with the whole Zen I Ching accidents thing, is whatever comes out, just leave it, don't correct it.
Just
it's the moment. It's
of that moment, and that's it.
Yeah. And what he sang at that time, he might have completely changed his mind 10 minutes later. What you say in one minute, you might change your mind the next minute.
It was exactly a snapshot of that moment.
Exactly.
You know, all these different circumstances came in a confluence at that point, and that's what you got.
Yeah, they're not lyrics that have been agonized over and rewritten so that they're perfect, so that they're everything that he wanted to say. Joe the Lion is absolutely brilliant, just for the guitar and riffs, and the fact that it's like it's just a sort of stompy rock song, basically.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward by hero standards, isn't it?
Pretty straightforward, but it's mad.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward, but like, listen to it. It's insane. The lyrics are insane. They don't really make any sense. It's all cut up.
Yeah, that's a classic cut up. You know, his kind of whole William Burroughs thing, where he literally throws the words up in the air and they come back down again. But I think you also have this, obviously, the narrative about the artist. But then there's something to me that's a very Berlin song. You know, there's something about, we were talking earlier about the being immersed in the underworld of Berlin at the time, and that song to me really has that atmosphere.
It's dirty.
Made of iron. It's like, it's almost, it's hysterical. It's like pushing, you can hear him like pushing his voice as far as he can go just on the choruses.
It's almost like some of the songs, just thinking about it, sort of remind me a bit of Aladdin Sane. Like, the rockier songs are Aladdin Sane, but done up in, like, the complete anti-Americanism.
Well, that's a good point,
Aladdin Sane was totally...
Like, the really, really demented tracks, Cracked Actor.
Yeah,
and his version of Let's Spend the Night Together and stuff. It's all on the verge of falling apart, but just...
It feel a bit like Let's Spend the Night Together, but that has got the same piano, same sort of instrumentation... And he always had that. He always had that ability to write those sort of, like TVC15, like those sort of funny little songs in the midst of a really dark, druggy atmosphere, where it's like just a sort of honky-tonk piano going on.
It's weird. I've never loved TVC15 for some reason. I can't. So because you're picking up all the songs that I'm kind of more or less indifferent to, like Blackout, TBC15,
right.
Let's Spend the Night Together.
I think
that's you've mentioned the ones that I'm really kind of
just
like.
Just the songs that you hate.
Songs I hate, indeed. Finally, one last thing is that I read somewhere you actually met Bowie.
I did meet Bowie.
At one point. Can you just tell us what happened?
I was playing with the band I was in at the time, it was Ash, and I was 22, so I joined Ash when I was in 97, when I was like 18, so this was like 2001, and it was an American tour, and it was Moby's tour, it was called Area 2, I think, and he sort of curated the lineup. And we were on first at like 4 PM, and then it was the Blue Man Group, and then Busta Rhymes. It was very, very
weird. Ash, Blue Man Group, Busta Rhymes.
It was pretty weird. And then Bowie.
Blimey.
And Moby. And it was Heathen. It was Heathen tour.
Oh, okay.
And it was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 gigs. And it was a touring festival in America. And when I found out that was happening, it was fucking crazy. And the first gig, I just remember seeing his dressing room, because we were on so early, it was like no one's there, and we played the gig, and then I was just sat backstage, and then you see like Mike Garson and Earl Slick, and
so this was that classic band he was talking about, Gail Ann Dorsey, Mike Garson, Earl Slick.
Yeah.
And was it Zachary Orford, the drummer?
No, it was Sterling Campbell.
That was, yeah.
So Sterling Campbell was playing drums. So we were partying a lot and then watching David Bowie every night. And I've never seen him before, so...
Wow, so you're actually on backstage watching.
It was huge. Well, I sort of went out front. I was sort of going out front, watching him, and then during the day I sort of made friends with Sterling Campbell, who was like incredibly generous and lovely, and they had sound checked Always Crashing in the Same Car, which is like my favourite song, and I said to Sterling, are you going to play it in the set? And he said, well, maybe, no, I don't know. And on the last gig I was just having lunch, and Sterling came up to me and said, oh, make sure you watch to the end of the show tonight. And he walked off. And in my mind, I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen?
He's going to get me on stage.
I know! I'm going to play the guitar solo. It's going to be amazing. I was thinking, all this crazy stuff. And I went out front and I watched it. And so they go off and then they come back in on stage. And David Bowie says, well, we're going to do a song that we haven't played live yet, we've just been rehearsing it, it's called Always Crashing in the Same Car, and this song's for him, and he looks back at Sterling and then he just sort of shrugs and goes, let's just and
no way,
it destroyed me a little bit.
I can imagine.
It was
so close.
And afterwards, I had a few drinks, and Mike Garson was there, and I actually said to Mike Garson, that was for me, but he forgot my name. He said, it was still for you. And I was like, it wasn't Mike, come on. and actually before that, I made myself introduce myself to him, because he was watching at the side of the stage, he was watching one of the bands, and Moby was talking to him, and then I was behind, and then Moby walked away, and I was like, took the moment, and I just went up and I said, I'm playing in the first band, and I'm a really big fan, and he just was talking to me about how he just had a baby, and he said, I have to fly home, because the tour started on the West Coast. He was in New York, and he said, I have to fly home every night, but once we hit the East Coast, I'll be able to watch you play. And I was like, sure. And just sort of walked away, and he was just so nice. But I can't remember what he looked like.
Right.
I have no memory of his face or anything. Other than what he was sort of saying, and I just think I was just in the state of extreme.
You would be, wouldn't you? You'd just
shock.
Be. Oh my God! God.
It was quite intense. And a little bit, like, kind of, in a weird way, I felt a bit sort of down afterwards.
Kind of anticlimactic.
It was really anticlimactic. Yeah.
That's weird, isn't it? That happens when you meet someone really famous. I've had that a couple of times. If I've met somebody really big, and you walk away afterwards, you'd be like, oh. And it's hard to explain. It's not.
It's hard to explain.
It's not disappointment. It's more like, like a sort of weird melancholy.
It's melancholy. And it's almost like, so I guess we're not going to be friends.
Yeah. That fantasy I've held dear for 20 years, it's not going to... I mean, I interviewed Duncan once. And afterwards, and he was really nice.
Mm.
But then afterwards, I remember just feeling so sad.
Mm.
And just like, oh, God, I made an absolute tit myself. He thinks I'm an idiot. Oh, God, Duncan Jones thinks I'm an idiot.
Oh, yeah.
And then just once or twice, you just, yeah.
That's happened to me.
I think most famous people I've interviewed have just been like, that guy, yeah, don't invite him again. Yeah, he was just gibbering like an idiot.
Yeah, I think I wanted to make an impression.
Isn't that it, though? Is that the thing? That's the thing you want to do. You want to be that person that, hey, I really get you.
Yeah.
I'm not like those crazy fans.
I could come out with really was, I'm a really big fan. And it was just so much else that I wanted to say. And the singer in my band, Tim, he was a big Bowie fan, but he was seemingly pretty unfazed.
Mm.
He was just chatting away to him at lunch, and he was like, you should go, just go up and talk to him. I was like, no, just...
You don't understand. I can't just go up and talk to him.
I can't do that. And there was one bit where I was talking to Sterling Campbell, and then Gail and Dorsey suddenly came up, and they were talking, and I was just stood there. And then David Bowie walked past, took a cigarette from Gail's hand, and sort of took a drag in a sort of, oh, I'm not supposed to be smoking, I think he'd given up, and then put it back, and then walked off. And they just kept on talking, and I was just stood there going, just, how is this happening?
Yeah.
It was never meant to be that we would be in the same small area.
And I think you do have these fantasies of him going, you know what, of all the people that have come up to me and said, I'm a really big fan, there's something
you're
about
special.
You
are special.
I'm looking for a guitarist for my next album. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, and you do have this kind of...
Well, I played with Brian Ferry. I played guitar with him years ago now, but I did like a year.
Mm.
But after I played with him, you know, in my mind, I was like, well, it's just a stone's throw from playing with Bowie.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm just...
You've got the Eno connection.
I've just been playing Virginia Plays. I mean, I might as well be in Bowie's band.
Okay, well, I think that's everything for Heroes. So, Charlotte, thank you so much for your time. It's been really nice talking to you.
Thank you very much.
And, yeah, hopefully you'll come back and do another album at some point.
I'd love to. I'd love to talk Tin Machine.
Tin Machine?
Mm.
Good, finally, somebody who's going to do Tin Machine. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, done. Yalla. Yeah.
Did you get what you wanted?
I think I did. And thanks, Charlotte, indeed, for a lovely talk. And I'm just back quickly to remind you that if you did like this podcast, please do subscribe, share it, like it, review it. All those wonderful things that would be really, really appreciated. And I just want to also point out that the music on this edition of the podcast is actually by Charlotte herself, and it's called The Lonely Waltz. So, yeah, many, many thanks to Charlotte for that. Do join us again next week for the third edition of Album to Album, where we have a lovely notable already lined up, and I will be uploading that very, very soon. So thanks again for listening. Do take care and have a nice week.